We'll hear the second half of my interview with Jesse next week. And that's it for this Magical Mystery Tour. Thank you so much for listening. If you missed any of the show or would like to hear it again, you can find this and all Magical Mystery Tour shows at soundcloud.com/WGDR. That's soundcloud.com/WGDR. And until next time, take good care of yourselves and each other.
Listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is listener-sponsored. That's right. 80% of our funding comes from donations from listeners just like you. You can always make a donation to help keep KBOO independent and non-commercial at kboo.fm/give. Right now, during our end-of-year drive, is the perfect time to contribute. Give now and help us reach our goal of $70,000 by December 31st. Make your tax-deductible year-end donation at kboo.fm/give today.
San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, the head of the Oath Keepers found guilty of sedition, facing 20 years in the clink. Also, an in-depth look at the ongoing revolution by the courageous young women rebelling in Iran. With a lot of support around the world, also Code Pink co-founder Medea Benjamin talks about her brand new book, War in Ukraine, Making Sense of a Senseless Conflict. We'll talk to Medea about the ongoing multiple dangers that that expanding war poses and why it's important to end it now. We'll also ask Medea a question or two about what's going on in Iran. All this coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. Well, we are happy to welcome back to these airwaves our good friend Medea Benjamin. She's got a brand new book with Nicholas J.S. Davies about what Ukraine to help us understanding and untangle what's going on there. We are happy to have access to the new book, and we're happy to have access to you, Medea Benjamin. Congratulations on War in Ukraine, Making Sense of a Senseless Conflict. Of course, it's a terrible situation, and it's getting more dangerous all the time. Medea, I have to say that this issue, what's going on in Ukraine now and the conflict with Russia in the middle, seems to be among the most difficult for our listenership to understand. And there's a lot of people on both sides of this issue. And if you dare to try and assign blame to anybody other than Putin, I get a hell of a response, and it's like I've become a Putin lover, deceived by this maniac. How do you respond to that?
Well, I always knew you were a Putin
and welcome,
lover,
by the way,
Dennis.
Welcome.
You know,
big hug.
People have been so brainwashed. It's so scary to see people who've been lifelong peace activists, people who call themselves pacifists or conscientious objectors and all kinds of things who, you know, their whole lives were saying, war is not the answer, war is not the answer. Suddenly war is the answer. And I think it's a couple of things. You know, it's the conditioning from Russiagate that Hillary Clinton lost the election because of Putin and Russia. It's the way the media has given us such a picture, like this is a war that fell from the sky. It's all Putin. And so, yeah, people have really been taken in by this more than other wars. And we have a big job to do to go around and talk to people, to educate them, to show them the context for this war. But, you know, I also try to get beyond all of that. You know, Dennis, I just gave a talk, and for 2 hours, putting this whole context and everything, and then in the end, a woman says, but you can't talk to Putin, after I give a whole long thing about why you have to talk to Putin. So it's hard to break through, but it's important to do that, and that's why we wrote the book, that's why I'm on this book tour, and most important is to not only convince other people, but to get them on board with us, that we've got to do something about this.
Well, a bunch of people really like your book, including Noam Chomsky. I love what he says. This careful, informed, judicious study is an invaluable guide to understanding Russia's criminal invasion of Ukraine, and most crucially, how we can act to help bring this terrible tragedy to an end. Do you want to enlarge a little bit on what Chomsky is saying there about what the real challenge is? How do we start? Where do we begin to sort of pull the truth cord and make some sense out of this? Because the loose talk about potential use of nuclear weapons and the ongoing meltdowns around the plants is insane.
Well, that's right. And at some point, I think people have to let go of whoever they think is most to blame and really focus on how do we stop a nuclear war from breaking out? How do we stop all these Ukrainians from being killed? We certainly condemn Russia and say this is a horrific invasion. We condemn all wars. We condemn all aggression. And we've got to say, all right, how does this thing get settled? How do we put the pressure on the people that we have some access to, which means our own leaders in Congress and in the White House, so that they push for negotiations? And Dennis, you probably followed that just ghastly incident with the 30 members of the Progressive Caucus who signed on to a letter calling for negotiations, and how quickly they got pushback from people like Nancy Pelosi, so intense that they withdrew that letter. So our issue now is how do we get those same people and more to go back to saying, oh, yes, actually, it was a rational letter. Oh, yes, we do have to push for negotiation.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Medea Benjamin. She has a brand new book, War in Ukraine, Making Sense of a Senseless Conflict. This is a powerful book. We are happy to have Medea. Let me tell you a little bit about, she is beloved in this community and really in many, but let me just tell you, give you a little bit of the formal background. Medea is the co-founder of the woman-led peace group Code Pink and the co-founder of the human rights group Global Exchange. She has been an advocate for social justice for more than 40 years, described as, quote, one of America's most committed and most effective fighters for human rights by New York Newsday, and one of the high-profile leaders of the peace movement by the Los Angeles Times. Again, she's a treasure in our community, and she has won also peace prizes and all kinds of prizes for her extraordinary work. Again, we're talking about her new book, War in Ukraine, Making Sense of a Senseless Conflict. And obviously, this is timely. I mentioned the nuke stuff before, but I have to say, I'm as frightened as I was as a kid during the Cuban Missile Crisis now, with the nature of the loose talk and the way these missiles and these bombs are landing around these dirty actors. I'm afraid, Medea. And everybody's saying this is the most dangerous time in our history in terms of the nuclear possibility of a nuclear meltdown since the Cuban Missile Crisis.
We just narrowly avoided a crisis when the missile landed in Poland and Zelensky said this came from Russia, and the Polish president said no, it came from Ukraine. And luckily, the Polish head of state was right, and Biden acknowledged that as well. And we were able to overcome that potential crisis of getting all of NATO directly involved in this war. But you don't think this is going to happen again? Then it might be a stray Russian missile that lands in one of the NATO countries like Poland, like Romania. Of course, that could easily happen. And that would be the invocation of what's called Article 5, in which the NATO countries would feel obligated to get directly involved, and that could lead to World War III, nuclear war, you name it. So you're right to feel scared, and if people aren't scared, it's because they're not paying attention. And, you know, some people say, well, you know, Putin is irrational, he's this, he's that. Well, if he's so irrational, then let's worry about him using a nuclear weapon and get down to the peace table. So that brings us, you know, first circle back again, and that's why I think it's so important, Dennis, to be in the Bay Area. I'm excited to be speaking at the Hillside Club on Thursday because Bay Area people are so strong on these issues. But, you know, people like Barbara Lee advocated the $40 billion, and there's another package of $37 billion that Biden has asked for that's going to be voted on any day now. And we need the Barbara Lees and the Squad and the Progressive Caucus to say no, to say enough of the weapons. Now is the time to call for a truce, a ceasefire. And we need, of course, the pressure, more pressure from the Bay Area on our elected officials. And I feel like Nancy Pelosi is one of the worst in terms of bringing down her power on the people who did sign a letter calling for negotiations. So we've got to really put the pressure on her.
I can just see the headline now. Code Pink goes after Nancy Pelosi on Flashpoints. I already had plenty of battles with her, as you can imagine. Let me remind people again that you are, for people listening in the Bay Area, you're going to be tomorrow at the Hillside Club with Mickey Huff of Project Censor talking about your new book, War in the Ukraine, Making Sense of a Senseless Conflict. That's happening again, tomorrow night. I believe that's at 7 p.m. for those of you listening in the Bay Area. Mindy, I want to ask you a question about the misreporting of that the attack that was allegedly by the Russians going on to now our NATO partner. You know, we know that AP has now corrected the fact that it didn't happen the way they said. But we still don't know which administration official. Now, we don't like Donald Trump because he's a perpetual liar, right? And he doesn't tell us the truth about the crucial things we need to know when he was president, about our republic, if you will. But don't you think it's important to know which administration official misled us almost into a nuclear war. Because we don't know which official.
Yes, we should know that, and we should know why our partner Zelensky refused to acknowledge the truth when it was made clear that this was not a Russian missile, and he kept insisting it was. So, yes, we deserve to know the truth, and we deserve to know why the media would go ahead and report things that haven't been verified. And that's part of what got us to where we are now, is the lack of accountability in both the officials in this country and the media.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just saying that truth is important. And when somebody who is clearly, this came out of the Defense Department, and when somebody, a high-level official in the Democratic regime here, misleads people in a way that is so risky. Truth has consequences, doesn't it? And this one could have taken us a far distance into the war where we don't want to go and where we can't come back from. So, Medea, just say a little bit more about, you know, how you go about, what is the discussion? What do you say to people who maybe are misguided, misled, love Rachel Maddow and MSNBC and it's like that's okay in terms of the kind of news and the kind of stenographer journalism that misleads us in the wrong. What do we need a whole new program of media interpretation? Do we need folks who can really tell us the truth about what's going on? How do we change this? Because I think the bottom line is that critical thinking in America has reached an all-time low. It's not just the folks being deceived by Trump. It's many in this country who cannot figure out what's really going on. And, it is so dangerous now.
Well, yes, and it is so crazy the way now those who are calling for negotiations and questioning the blank check are some of the most extreme Republicans. In Congress, you have Marjorie Taylor Greene, you have Paul Kusar, really right-wing folks who are saying we have unmet needs at home that have to be dealt with. And you have Donald Trump saying, if I were in power, I'd talk to Putin and we would solve this problem. And you have people like Tucker Carlson on Fox News saying that the only way to end this is through negotiations. So it is so topsy-turvy the way the ones who now are putting themselves forward as, quote, peacemakers, and yet our friends in the more progressive movement in Congress are really now afraid and cowed to say something that is so rational. I think Ro Khanna, the congressman, is the only one who had the courage to stand by his signature on that letter and say, well, of course, it was totally rational. Of course we should be calling for negotiations. Yes, things are very, very topsy-turvy, confusing for people. And that's why I go back to the basics and say, you know, what did we learn about other interventions, whether it's a Russian intervention or a U.S. intervention? They mean death, destruction, killing, lies, propaganda. It's a lose-lose situation except for the weapons industry and the energy companies that are profiting now from the sanctions on Russian energy. But for the rest of us all over the world, it's a lose-lose situation.
Yes, it is. We're speaking with Medea Benjamin. Medea, we just have a couple of minutes left, and I can't let you go without getting your response to what's going on the ground in Iran. You've written extensively about Iran. You know the country. I know you must be thinking deeply about this. What are some of your thoughts about this uprising by these young women with great support from many?
Well, Yes, I mean, it is a very courageous what these women are doing, and it is important that we support their efforts to have the agency over their own bodies, over their own lives. The government in Iran has been repressive for many years. I'm very much against Islamic government, just as I'm against any kind of religious government. I totally believe in separation of religion and state, and yet I'm also fearful the way outside influences are trying to take advantage of the situation, whether it's Israel, the U.S., Saudi Arabia, independence groups, everybody, all these groups that have their own agendas, and so that complicates the issue very much. The U.S., the U.S. policy towards Iran has emboldened the hardliners, has brought hardliners into the presidency. And, of course, we have to think of how different Iran would be today if the U.S. never interfered back in the 1950s to overthrow their democratically elected government. But we have to work today to stop U.S. interference and let the Iranian people decide their own future.
Good point, Medea Benjamin. You can see Medea tomorrow night. If you're in the Bay Area, you can check her out at the Hillside Club. She is being hosted by Mickey Huff, and she'll be talking about her new book, War in Ukraine, Making Sense of a Senseless Conflict. Medea, thanks for all the great work you do and for joining us today on Flashpoints.
Thank you. I hope your listeners will come and join us so we can talk about what we can do and get the copies of the books around. Thank you so much, Dennis. Good talking to you.
All right. Be safe. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are going to take a short break, and then we're going to have a report from the East Coast about the verdict in the Oath Keepers trial. The leader there didn't do so well. It's a mixed verdict, though. Stay with us. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, we turn our attention to the Oath Keepers trial, which reached a verdict today. Stuart Rhodes, the leader of the far-right Oath Keepers militia, and one of its subordinates were convicted on Tuesday of seditious conspiracy as a jury found them guilty of seeking to keep former President Donald J. Trump in power through a plot that started after the 2020 election and culminated in the mob attack on the Capitol. And we're going to talk all about that right now with somebody who has been watching the trial, covering the trial, and writing about the trial for a number of different sources. We're happy to have him. He's been writing for Raw Story, The Nation, Washington Post, Guardian, Jacobin. Arun Gupta, welcome back to Flashpoints. Well, it's a mixed verdict, but Stuart Rhodes didn't make out so well. It was an interesting prosecution. It was a bit of a risk, but I think it was effective, at least in part, because some of the Oath Keepers were not willing to take the full brunt of it and turn state's witness. You want to give us a sense of how you see the verdicts, how it looks to you, somebody who's been covering this? Was this a major success, even though it's a mixed verdict?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think any observer expected all five of the Oath Keepers to be found guilty of everything. There were, I think, something like 14 charges in total, various types of conspiracy charges. The one everyone was really, you know, on an edge about was the seditious conspiracy. One, because it is very rarely used. This is a Civil War era law that basically says you have to be engaged in a conspiracy, you have to be using force, and you need to be engaged in trying to do something like overthrow the government or to prevent or hinder some law from being carried out. And the last time the feds tried this was against a Christian militia extremist group in 2012 called the Hutari Militia, and the judge threw out all the charges. They were acquitted of this, or not all the charges, they were acquitted of the seditious conspiracy charges. There was some of them were later found guilty of weapons charges, but the judge said, you know, that yes, you know, they may have been engaging in all this bombastic rhetoric, but it wasn't a plan. And then in 2016, the government completely botched the prosecution of the Bundy brothers, Eamon and Ryan right. Bundy, who are the sons of Clive and Bundy, the rancher who came to prominence in the Nevada standoff a couple years earlier. And they were completely acquitted. And now the problem there was stemmed from a jury that demanded an absurd level of proof. But nonetheless, in both these instances, you have these very high-profile prosecutions that failed. And so there was fear that this would happen again. So the fact that Stuart Rhodes was found guilty is a really big deal, as well as one of his co-conspirators, Kelly Meggs. Because for one, Stuart Rhodes was the Oath Keeper. He was the founder and the leader. In conversations that I had with his estranged wife, Tasha Adams, that I wrote about on the Daily Beast, he was using it like his slush fund. For weapons, she claimed, for sex workers, he would buy hundreds of pairs of shoes, you know, and that was part of the prosecution case in terms of this Jan 6 trial, that he spent something like $40,000 on weapons. And I've been critical of the DOJ approach to Jan 6, as have a lot of other observers, from two angles. One is from the lower level people. They've let off hundreds of people with minor prison sentences, or even let them walk free. They've given them these just irrelevant $500 fines, given, you know, this enormous cost and five people dead. The DOJ could have very easily charged everyone involved who was arrested as accessory to murder, which the prosecutors do all the time in terms of drug crimes. Secondly, right. You know, as many people have discussed, Garland has really seemed to slow walk going after Donald Trump, right? So from both like the kind of like the ants on the ground to the mastermind, the DOJ has been seemingly not up to the task. But in this case, what they did is they did build a very strong case. And as opposed right. to the Hutari militia, they did show that there was definitely a plan. They used a lot of Stuart Rhodes' own messages that were on encrypted signal chats, but they seized the cell phones of Oath Keepers to get at these chats, where he's talking about a bloody revolution, a civil war that he put out. He was saying stuff publicly about how we need to organize and send people to D.C. We need a quick reaction force. We have to, you know, stop Biden, who's a Chi-Com, meaning Chinese communist puppet, from coming to power. You know, he's telling other Oath Keepers, you have to be prepared to die. Other Oath Keepers who were on trial with him or still have to go on trial were organizing military trainings weeks before Jan 6 for unconventional warfare, for how to do ambushes and assaults, Jessica Watkins, who is one of the ones today who was acquitted of seditious conspiracy but found guilty of numerous other charges. She was recruiting members and telling, giving them, leading them in basic training so they would be fighting fit by inauguration. So you have all these different elements that are going on. You know, Rhodes is also encouraging people to go to D.C. and he's involved in all this planning, and they set up this arsenal that one Oath Keeper said of it was in Virginia, right across the river, Potomac River from D.C. One Oath Keeper said it was the most weapons he had ever seen in one place outside the military. And we have to remember the whole point of the Oath Keepers, Stuart Rhodes, who is an Army veteran, he was 82nd Airborne, is that they were recruiting from ex-military and former cops, right? And that's one of the things we saw on Jan 6th that shocked so many people who weren't paying attention, was how many former or current police and military were involved in this assault. You know, and, you know, there's the whole issue of this being blowback from the war on terror, that essentially the U.S. government was training its own insurrectionists. So I think this is a pretty big deal, and there's more cases to come. You know, the real thing that I think is important is the issue of the Proud Boys. You know, Enrique Torrijo, and we'll talk about him in the future, who I've had, let's say, the privilege of interviewing in person a number of times, same with Joe Biggs. Who's also on trial, who's going to be tried. And I've talked to him, and he's also been locked up for months. And I know Torrijo is also looking at seditious conspiracy charges. But I think the real question is the government going to shut down the Proud Boys, who have been taking the lead in terms of terrorizing abortion providers, and now they've been bringing their violence, threats of violence, to these drag queen story hours.
Well listen, I'm sorry to interrupt, but you know, you're going to have to get the Attorney General out of hiding in order to see some of these prosecutions happen. Come on, Arun, let's face it. Special prosecutor now? Let's start all over again?
Yeah.
This guy is in hiding. He takes the threats of these Republicans very seriously. I guess he's trying to keep himself clean for maybe some dream in the future to be a Supreme Court justice. He doesn't want any of this controversy, any of these hassles. Would you say? By the way, we're just about out of time, but another problem that the leader of the Oath Keepers had was the fact that a couple of the folks became state's witness, and that didn't help him at all. Gordon Young, I guess Josh Dolan.
Quite a few of them did. Yeah, yeah. You know,
they were not so brave.
No, but you know, I do want to pick up on that Garm point, because I think there's a very important point that we need to think about.
Yes.
You know, which is how the Democratic leadership keeps running after cops and conservatives, right? James Comey, Robert Mueller, Liz Cheney, Merrick Garland, right? All of them are like center right to hard right, and who have been the ones who are supposed to hold Trump and these extremists accountable, and they've all been pretty much deeply flawed at best, if not disastrous. And you know, we have these reports coming out about how Liz Cheney is trying to suppress everything in the Jan 6 evidence that doesn't talk directly about Trump, and her office even issued this just completely bombastic statement. And remember, a Cheney is a Cheney is a Cheney, about how, you know, there's supposed to be an element of the report coming out talking about the far right extremist groups, but Cheney is now apparently trying to excise that completely to just focus just solely on Trump because she wants to advance her political career. And she says that they are trying to impugn patriots. And it's just like that. She's showing her hand that she thinks these extremist groups like the Proud Boys, like the Oath Keepers, like the Three Percenters, who were the spearhead, the spear tip of this white nationalist deadly coup attempt, are patriotic Americans. That's what she basically just, she said that outright, right? And so the Democrats keep making heroes of these, like, conservatives and cops. And it keeps blowing up in the face, their face, and you have to wonder why. You know, where it's just like, are they ever going to learn?
You want to answer that, or should I?
Lucy at the football, right?
We used to play Saluji when I was growing up. You know what that is? Saluji. It's a game of football where there's no goals. You just throw it. Whoever gets the ball gets tackled and beaten up.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to hold this ball. They keep throwing it because they're afraid they're going to get tackled and beaten. And it's a shame because, you know, this thing about no person above the law is such a joke. And in terms of an example for young people coming up, I was a teacher for 15 years, and this kind of stuff comes up, and they say, don't tell me about the justice system. Don't tell me about truth and all that stuff. This is a problem in this country now, and it's not just Trump. Leave it there. Arun Gupta writing beautifully and powerfully on this trial and on this extreme right wing that we've been following. He's been doing it for a bunch of places, including Raw Story, The Daily Beast, The Guardian, Jacobin, The Nation, Washington Post, others. Thank you, Arun. Please keep us posted on what comes next.
Thank you, Dennis.
All right, take it easy. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to turn our attention back to Iran, and we're going to get into it big time. And it's troubling, it's inspiring, and we need to know what's going on the ground there. Stay with us. Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Love the music. Thanks, Mike. You are listening to Flashpoints. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We turn our attention back to Iran, the powerful uprising in Iran against its reactionary Islamic Republic is now in its 11th week since the September 16 killing of Mahsa Amini. At the hands of Iran's notorious mortality police, there have been protests in over 100 cities and college campuses across Iran involving people from all walks of life demanding women's rights, political rights, and increasingly an end to the rule of the Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei and the Islamic Republic. Women, life, freedom. Iran's draconian theocracy has responded with illegitimate, often murderous force, mass arrests, and widespread threats and terror against the protesters, even their families and relatives, killing hundreds and imprisoning thousands. Yet people have continued to protest and speak out. With us to discuss the roots of this rebellion and current developments is Larry Everest. Everest is a spokesperson for the International Emergency Campaign to Free Iran's Political Prisoners. Now, a correspondent for Revolution, that's RevComUS.us, who reported from Iran. Larry reported from Iran during 1979-1980, and he's the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq, and the U.S. Global Agenda. Larry Everest, welcome back to Flashpoints. You have been on this story from 1979. You have been on the cutting edge, telling people things that they're learning now about the nature of this republic. We thank you for joining us. Let's begin, Larry, remind people how this uprising began, and then give us a sense of how far it has spread.
Great to be with you, Dennis. The uprising was triggered by the death of one woman, a Kurdish woman, Mahsa Amini. Why was she killed? She was killed by the so-called morality police because apparently she had a lock of hair that was showing out from under her scarf, and that was enough for her to be arrested, beaten, and ended up dying. And when that happened on September 16th of this year, the seething anger of the Iranian people at this very oppressive regime. There have been big demonstrations and outbreaks of mass protests in 2017, in 2019, particularly around poverty, around economic deprivation, around rising prices, around the lack of political rights. But this was touched off by the treatment of a woman. And in Iran's Islamic theocracy, a fundamentalist theocracy, women are not treated as full human beings. They don't have the same rights as men in marriage, in divorce, in childcare. They're even forbidden from riding a bike, dancing in public, jogging. Women can be forced to marry into marriage at 13, but they can't get a divorce unless a male judge says it's okay. And the morality police and this enforcement of a patriarchal, reactionary, sort of the Islamic fundamentalist version of the Handmaid's Tale in terms of dress on Iranian women is a constant source. Tens of thousands of women each year are stopped, are cited, are arrested, are hassled for so-called violations of this code. So this is what triggered it, and this is one of the reasons that women have been such an important driving force of these protests. I'm sure many of the listeners have seen videos of women taking off their scarves, their hijab, and throwing them in the fire and burning them. There are other pictures of women around the world and in Iran who are cutting their hair. Hair is seen as a sign of honor and beauty and so on. And this is, but it must be covered. And this is a way of protesting that forced wearing of the hijab. This isn't a protest against anyone who wears a hijab. It's an uprising against forcing people to adhere to this patriarchal dress code. And since this uprising was triggered on September 16th with the news of Mahsa's death, there have been protests in over 156 cities, over 140 college campuses. One of the most amazing things, and there's a really the direction of it is increasingly going to getting rid of the entire regime. For example, one of the things the young people have done on these college campuses is they're supposed to be segregated by sex. Men can't dine with women. And they've broken down some of the walls and come together, eaten together. And that sounds like a very simple thing, but that can land you in jail with very, very serious consequences. And one of the things that's very notable, I'm glad you mentioned 1979. That's when this regime was formed. I was there when they were, consolidating power. The Islamists were. They were murdering my friends. They were imprisoning the leftists and the Democrats and the progressives and the communists. And you know, it was a nightmare from the beginning. In fact, in 1988, they murdered over 5,000 political prisoners in the space of a few months. But it's very significant that the current uprising is the most serious challenge to this regime in its 43-year history. And you know, this is people in oppressed nationalities in Kurdistan and Baluchistan and Khuzestan and Azerbaijan. It's workers, it's impoverished people, it's youth and students and women, and it's also very prominent people, actors, poets, artists. Two very prominent actors were arrested, and we saw this today, and at the World Cup soccer tournament, where you have Iranians holding up protest signs and being threatened by pro-regime thugs as well as the police.
And that threat, let's face it, Larry, that's what I wanted to sort of talk to you about. That threat is not going to end. The folks who took a stand in support of this transformation are going to pay for it. And I just, in that context, talk a little bit about how the regime has responded and what more we can expect at that level.
Well, you're right, Dennis. This is a bloodthirsty regime, and it's responded by increasing violence against the protesters. Over 450 have been killed, and sickeningly, 63 of those have been children, at least, children as young as 10 years old. Over 18,000 people have been arrested or detained, including hundreds of students. And as our campaign, which has begun in 2020, any prisoners in Iran face a lack of legal rights, face solitary confinement and other forms of torture, face sham trials, forced confessions, and the possibility of death. And one of the very stunning and outrageous things that happened is that the parliament recently voted to authorize the government to charge protesters, and these are overwhelmingly unarmed, nonviolent protests, and to charge protesters with being enemies of God, acting against God, which could potentially subject them to the death penalty. Right now, there's a very prominent rapper, Tumaj Saleh, who was imprisoned, who was beaten, you know, for his music, for standing with the people, and for rapping for the people. And they've refused to let his family lawyer view the case. And there are worries that he is also going to be charged with the death penalty. But the response of the Iranian people in the face of this has been, look, I'm not saying there haven't, you know, been ebbs and flows of the protests, although not a day has gone by in the 11 weeks of this uprising without a protest someplace, and probably dozens of places in Iran. But people have continued to stand up courageously because there's a sense that they've just had enough, and there's a feeling that, you know, they have the support of millions of Iranians. And I think one of the really crucial things that it's so important for people in this country to do is speak up on behalf of the Iranian people. I've gone to, there have been a lot of protests by Iranians, and I'm going to mention a few before we get off the phone here, Dennis, that are happening tomorrow, actually. right here in the Bay Area.
Okay, but I'll give you a chance to do that. We have some time, right. So we will yeah. definitely get to that.
Let me
tell people, Larry. Let me let people know you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Larry Everest. We're talking about the roots of the rebellion, current rebellion in Iran. We're speaking again with Larry Everest. Larry is a spokesperson for the International Emergency Campaign to Free Iran's Political Prisoners Now. He's a correspondent for RevolutionRevCom.us. He has reported from Iran during the 1979-1980 uprisings, and he has a book called Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq, and the U.S. Global Agenda. And Larry, your work early on has been crucial. Talk more about what perhaps people in the United States should do, and maybe you should start by talking about the role that the United States has played in the politics that the U.S. has played that has led or sort of supported this in a way.
Well, it definitely has. People in this country have a huge responsibility, A, to find out what this country has done to the people of Iran, and B, to support the uprising of the Iranian people, and to oppose efforts by these imperialists who run the United States to use the uprising as an opportunity for them to try to get their clutches back into Iran, or to shape what comes out of, if something comes out of this, or possibly to bolster these repressive theocrats that are in power now. I mean, the United States...
It wouldn't be the first time, Larry, that the United States did that. We wouldn't be surprised.
No, it would not,
you know?
Would it?
you know, I wrote a deck of cards called Friendly Dictator Trading Cards, 36 of America's allies.
There were 52 of them, I think, as I remember. You know,
36 in that version, but go on.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, Larry. But go on about the U.S.
Right.
role here. Yeah.
You're right. Well, listen, you know, this goes back to 1953. I mean, we could trace it back further than that, but in 1953, the CIA organized a coup d'etat that overthrew basically a populist government led by Mossadegh that was nationalizing Iran's oil. And look, in all this stuff we hear about the British Empire and the crown and, you know, Downton Abbey and all this stuff about the British monarchy and royalty, they don't mention that Britain plundered Iran's oil, and then when the Iranian people tried to nationalize it, the British and the CIA organized a coup and put the fascist dictator, the Shah, in power. And this is one of the things that paved the way for the rise of Ayatollah Khomeini and the religious fundamentalists. You know, during the U.S., and I talk about this in my book, in the 1980s, the U.S. encouraged a bloody war between Iran and Iraq, and fed both sides intelligence and arms and so on and so forth. And this is a war that took a million casualties, in which Iraq used chemical weapons against the United States. The U.S.
got from the United States, these chemical and biological weapons. They got them from the United States.
Exactly.
Anybody remember Henry Gonzalez, the former banking chairman who held hearings for 2 years about the way in which U.S. corporations were making available chemical weapons, biological weapons for the Iraqis to use on the Iranians? And Rumsfeld, there's a famous picture of Rumsfeld in the field with Iraq, and he's sharing intelligence for how the Iraqis can shoot the chemistry to the Iranians. And then we've got on the other side, you remember the late and great journalist, why am I blanking on his name? who was in the train in Iran with hundreds of sick Iranians who were suffering from the chemistry that the United States provided to Iraq, that Rumsfeld had the gave the coordinates so that they could shoot it and hit the population centers in Iran. I mean, it is sick, isn't it, Larry? People think I'm probably crazy. This
no,
all
take
happened,
a look
right?
In my book, I have a whole chapter on the Iran-Iraq war in oil, power, and empire. And one of the things people do not realize, look, you know, RevCom, Bob Avakian has analyzed this. These are two reactionary, outmoded forces that reinforce each other even as they clash. You support either, you strengthen both. For example, most people do not know, and the BBC recently revealed this, that Ayatollah Khomeini, just after the Shah had left the country, wrote to the United States and said, help me put into power. I will be a force for stability. I won't let this country go further to the left and maybe have a real left wing or communist revolution or pro-Soviet move. So, you know, these are all the different ways that the U.S. has been involved. And right now, right.
And
incredible.
By the way, Larry, you said the Shah left the country. You know, I think I met you at the protest where the Shah had been given permission to come to the United States because he needed some medical care.
Medical care, right, exactly, right. And no, that's right. We did big protests, and all of this, it's important. Look, supporting the people of Iran does not mean supporting U.S. intervention or U.S. sanctions or U.S. machinations. And on the contrary, refusing to do that or turning a blind eye to this enormous courage we're seeing, which frankly, we need a lot more of that throughout the whole world against all this, these horrors you were just talking with Arun Gupta about, you know, to all of this. And not to stand with the Iranian people is just chauvinist blindness, living in the top of the food chain here. Or, you know, if you're saying it's because, no, I refuse to, you know, supporting the Iranian people is supporting the U.S., and the CIA, no, supporting, if you're not supporting the Iranian people, it means you're condemning 40 plus million Iranian women to enslavement. That's what you're doing,
million.
And that's under 40 unconscionable. So we're calling, the IEC is calling for a global outcry, and I'll give the details, you know, when you give me the word.
Okay, that's the International Emergency Campaign, just to let people know it's called,
yeah,
that you're working with the International
Emergency
campaign
to free
Iran's
political
prisoners now, right?
Now
is in
exactly.
There. Not
yeah.
later,
and
now.
Now, and that's the name of the website, Free Iran's Political Prisoners Now. .org. People can find it easily. You can get hold of us and so on. But we're calling for freedom for the prisoners, a global outcry and support. I also want to point people to revcom.us because A, every week we're posting updates on this. B, because look, a lot of people in Iran and around the world are talking about this becoming a revolution. Okay, revolution's a very serious thing that takes organization and leadership, and one of the things we do at revcom.us is feature the analysis of communists in Iran, the Communist Party of Iran, MLM, Marxist, Leninist, Maoist. They are providing leadership and analysis. So if people are interested in that dimension of things, I encourage them to go to RevCom and check this out. And
what if they just want to in some way materially or whatever help out, or even is there any, you know, you know, Larry, many people, many activists go and stand and lock arms with the people on the ground. Is there such a movement now? I know many of us, you included, spent time going to the countries where the United States was making war against. What are the tactics to really mitigate the suffering and call attention around the world? Well, you know, is there a movement to be there, to stand with?
Well, you know, no, there isn't, because the practice of the Islamic Republic is to take people and imprison them, use them as bargaining chips if they're from a foreign country. We have cases of that, dual nationals that we're fighting now. Here's some things people can do. First of all, get hold of the IEC. Again, freeiranspoliticalprisonersnow.org. And get in contact via the website. You can also call. There's a very active chapter in the Bay Area. You can call Ray at 510-575-3159. That's 510-575-3159. And they'll be at, you know, and they, you know, you can get involved with the campaign. One thing we have done is publish full-page ads calling for freedom for the political prisoners in Ms. Magazine and the New York Review of Books. These have been signed by people like Dan Ellsberg, Noam Chomsky, Gloria Steinem, Shireen Abadi, Ariel Dorfman, the world-famous poet that I know, you know, you know well. That's one thing. Another thing is join in the protests that are happening in the Bay Area in support of Iran. Tomorrow, Wednesday, more than 100 UC campuses have solidarity with Iran rallies. UC Berkeley and Davis are at noon. Stanford is at 2 p.m. These have been called by the Iranian Scholars for Liberty. And that's, they have a website of that name. So that's tomorrow at noon at Berkeley, 2 o'clock at Stanford. There are also letters that are going around that we can, you know, that are being signed and circulated. So right now, but listen, just
okay. 15 seconds. We're against the clock now. 15 seconds.
People in the United, right in this country, get these non-Iranians living in this country out in the streets. Non-Iranians out in the street, not just Iranians. Okay, Dennis, great to talk to you.
Thank you, Larry. Beautiful, Larry. Thanks for all the very good information. Be safe, okay?
Okay, you too, man. Take care.
All right. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're out of here.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm. You probably know that KBOO Community Radio is listener-sponsored, but did you know that 80% of our funding comes from donations?